donkey. Now they praise him while they kill us in his day. They have given all his clothes to all the soldiers, and they getting ready to put that cross on you. If there's anybody out there who can hear me, I'm screaming from way, way down here below. In this lonely, lovely place that we're living in, there's a whole lot of jive going on. And if I'll be strong enough to finish my story, you will see what a movie this has been. There are brothers and sisters who think how you look is all it is. There are cities where people never say hello. There are men who think they built this world and can destroy it. They are puppets pulling.
Uhuru, and welcome to the People's War Radio Show. I'm Dr. Matsumela Odom, your host for this episode of the People's War Radio Show. Uhuru means freedom in Swahili, and freedom is something we want on our minds day and night. The piece you just heard is entitled, If There's Anybody Out There, by the late Hugh Masekela. As Bra Hugh's 1968 track suggests, the solution to the shared oppression of African people globally is unified resistance. Today's show is entitled, Black Power in the Great White North, and we will be examining the African liberation struggle in Canada. Though the countries are adjacent to each other, many Africans in the U.S. have very little knowledge of African life in Canada. I personally have family in Canada who live as far west as Vancouver and as far east as Toronto. In fact, I recently returned from visiting family in Calgary, Alberta, where my in-laws live. However, before I met my wife almost 20 years ago, I didn't know much about the Great White North. In all seriousness, what I generally understood about Canada revolved around sports and anti-slavery activity. In the 1700s, Nova Scotia, a province on Canada's eastern seaboard, was a destination for Africans who fought against the U.S. in the Revolutionary War. Some of the African revolutionaries, such as Osborne Anderson, that participated in the raid on Harper's Ferry, had come from Canada. There's a rich history of African liberation struggle in Canada. In fact, by 1922, there were 32 chapters of the Universal Negro Improvement Association in Canada. Malcolm X's parents met in Canada as Universal Negro Improvement Association organizers. However, this long history of struggle up north has been concealed by one simple fact: Canada is not the United States. But the truth is, Canada is the United States. Canada is so much the United States that the colonizers that founded the United States wrote a provision that would have allowed Canada to join the United States. Like the United States, South Africa, Israel, and Australia, Canada is a white settler colony that was built on the theft of indigenous land and the theft of the labor of African, Asian, and indigenous people. Until the 1960s, Africans, Asians, and Indians were largely prohibited from migrating to Canada. In 1967, Canada adopted what is called a point system that increased the immigration of African people from the Caribbean and the continent. Modern Canada has been built on the backs of Africans and other colonized people. Yet despite popular myths, Africans in Canada are not much better than Africans in the U.S. Africans make up 3% of Canada, but 9% of Canada's prisons. On top of that, Indigenous people are about 5% of Canada and 26% of its prisons. Africans in Canada have higher unemployment rates and lower income than the national average. And data shows that the longer Africans live in Canada, the harder life gets. Africans in Canada suffer from police brutality, and are 2 to 3 times more likely to die from COVID-19. What's the solution to these issues? The solution to these disparities is Black power. As noted, our show today is entitled Black Power in the Great White North. And our guest is Jalali, also known as Norm Otis Richmond. Jalali was born in Louisiana and raised in Los Angeles. He moved to Canada in the late 1960s, where he became an early leader in the African Liberation Movement in Canada. Jalali has dedicated his life to revolutionary cultural work. He has worked with a host of musicians such as Bob Marley, Abby Lincoln, Hugh Masekela, and Fela Kuti. Jalali is the host and producer of the Diasporic Music Show on Black Power 96 FM in St. Petersburg, Florida. Diasporic Music provides an all-African mix of music and politics that is, quote, made in the West, but not of the West. Diasporic Music airs every Sunday from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Welcome, Comrade Jalali.
Uhuru, how are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
Oh, as Sam Cooke would say, wonderful.
Oh, man. Did you ever meet Sam Cooke while you were in Los Angeles?
I never met Sam Cooke. However, I used to see his manager. His manager was a guy by the name of J.A. Alexander, I think. And I used to see him at there. Used to be a club in California, in Los Angeles, called a California Club. And J.W. Alexander, pardon me. He was a singer, and also he was a, I think he was a professional baseball player, but I used to see him, it was a California club, and he was a great dancer. At that time, he was an older guy, but he was in very good shape, had a head full of white hair, and dressed impeccably, and he could strut, he could dance. I used to see him, but I never met Sam, but I met his brother, L.C. Cooke, and I was very close to L.C. Cooke. There are many interviews with myself and L.C. on Uhuru Radio.
Uhuru, Uhuru. That's an excellent way to begin our questions. You are from Los Angeles, not Toronto. Can you tell the listeners how you got to Toronto?
Oh, well, first of all, my mother tells me I was conceived in Los Angeles, and I was born in Arcadia, Louisiana. And this another person that was born in Arcadia, Louisiana was Betty Swan, Make Me Yours. And I still don't know whether or not I was introduced to her as she was supposedly my cousin. And whether or not that's true or not, I don't know. All I know is I met her in Arcadia, Louisiana in 1963. I spent the whole summer in Louisiana in 1963. In that area, we also had Bobby Rush, another Louisiana man. He says he's my cousin, too. About you, Bobby Rush, the great blues man. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty interesting. You, as well as a lot of different Africans, actually come from North and Northwest Louisiana.
Well, I could go through Paul Mooney, what's his name, Johnny Cochran, Paul Mooney, Bunchy Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter, the Black Panther Party, and also Masai Hewitt.
Oh, Masai. Wow.
Masai Hewitt was the Minister of Education for the Black Panther.
So can you tell us how you got to Canada?
What had happened was I was a part of the student movement in Los Angeles. I went to Los Angeles City College, and Los Angeles City College at that particular time, we had a student union. And at that particular time, some of the people that were going to Los Angeles City College were Sagidi Abdullah. Sagidi Abdullah, he was the person who wrote and produced the SOS band, Baby Take Your Time, Do It Right. He was going there. Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter, who became the Minister of Defense for the Black Panther Party, he was going there at that particular time. And also there was a young man by the name of Fred Goray, who went to Detroit and became Masai Kariga Kenyatta. And he was a big DJ on a radio station in Detroit. And he was a member of the Shrine of the Black Madonna, Reverend Jeremoji. Or Reverend Clay, who Malcolm X talks about on the Message to Grassroots. And I went to LACC, and I was involved in the movement. I was drafted, and I basically took the position that if I got drafted, I was going to go to jail, and I was not going to run to Canada. I was not going to do this. I wasn't going to do that. I was going to go to jail. And the elders, one of the elders being Masai, who was minister, like he, who became the Minister of Education for the Black Panther Party, they basically had a meeting and decided on my behalf that they didn't want me to go to prison. So they basically said, you should leave the country. Like, you're 20 years old, almost turning 21. And it is our position that you should leave. You know, you can go to Cuba, you can go to Africa, you go to Canada, you can do this, you can do that. And basically, I was voted by the elders to get out of the country. They said, don't go. It's not worth going to prison. You know, too young. You can learn a lot. You know, I was part of a group called the Self-Determination Committee. And we sued the United States government. We said that we were colonial subjects. This is 1966, 1967. That we sued the government and said that we were colonial subjects and we shouldn't fight in the draft. We shouldn't pay taxes. We should withdraw all of our support. There was a man who was head of that organization. His name was Robert Brock. Chairman O'Malley Ishtel knew Robert Brock personally, as they say. I was on trial with another young man who was part of a nationalist group. They took the position that their mother was sick, so therefore I was going to take all of the weight. They basically set me up. So I was convicted, given 5 years prison and $5,000 fine. So as they say, Marcus Garvey would say, I got into the whirlwind and ended up in Toronto, Canada.
So upon entering Canada, what did you find were the general conditions of African life in Toronto and throughout Canada?
Well, when I came to Canada, it was in 19, I stayed in Canada in 1967 for about a year. First of all, there were only, at that particular time, maybe only 10,000 Africans, maybe 5,000, 10,000, no more than 20,000 Africans in Toronto at that particular time. And I remember I came to a place called Yorkville. Yorkville was like the hippie area. And the first African I saw was a brother. And I spoke to him and he was mute. So, you know, being born in Los Angeles and being born in Los Angeles and spending time in the South, you know, African people, we speak to one another. You know what I mean? When I saw the first brother I saw him, he looked at me like I had Ebola I was a leper or something. So that really kind of shook me up. And I met I met a group of people. I don't know if they were hippies, but they had it was three or four of them. I remember their names, but I don't want to go into their names because I really lost touch with them. It was a bunch of young white dudes. And there was one First Nations woman with them, a young First Nations woman. And they put me up, and then I met the Quakers. You know what? You had to go see the Quakers, and the Quakers had the Underground Railroad, and the Quakers put me in contact with some progressive Jewish folks, some anti-Zionist Jewish folks, and they gave me a little place to stay. And I had a little basement apartment, and they looked after me for a little while, and then I started mingling with the African community, and I met a young man by the name of Jose Garcia, who's still in the land of the living. And there was another brother from the United States. I hooked up with him. And all of these guys were older than me. And Jose Garcia was from the Dominican Republic and Aruba. He's a strange brother. When I say a strange brother, Jose could speak English, French, Spanish, Dutch, and a language called Papiamento. Jose could speak about six or seven languages. And we started the group called the Afro-American Progressive Association. And a lot of Caribbean people were upset because they said we were using the term Afro-American and they were West Indians. We took the term Afro-American from Malcolm X. And that Malcolm X says that, you know, Afro-Americans were people from Canada all the way to Chile. But we found out later that Carlos Cooks was from the Dominican Republic, but I think his people were from St. Croix or from the Caribbean. But anyway, Carlos Cooks was the person who took over the Garvey movement after Marcus Garvey. And he started the African Nationalist Pioneer Movement. And when we use the term Afro-American, it meant all of the Africans that were in the Western Hemisphere. And, you know, and he used African, Afro-American, and Black, you know. So we basically said that we would come in. We basically were using the term African or African-American to include all the Black people from the Western Hemisphere.
Thanks for that. Generally, when people think about Canada, they oftentimes don't talk about the colonial violence that Africans have experienced in Canada. Are there some specific examples in colonial violence that you can think of that Africans have experienced in Canada and Africans have campaigned against?
Well, first of all, there were lynchings in Canada, and historically, you know, Canada was supposedly a haven for runaway enslaved Africans. However, let's go back to 1953. There was a young man by the name of Garfield Belfont. And Garfield Belfont was 14 years old. He was killed by the police in 1953. They had no guns or anything, but they were supposedly robbing a pharmacy or something right on the street called College Street. But Garfield Belfont was 14 or 13 or 14. And anyway, everybody says that Garfield Belfont was like a Fred Hampton. I mean, he was leading. People that he was leading were older than him. His brother, John Belfont, was a founding member of the Afro-American Progressive Association. And I knew Garfield's mother, Mrs. Belfont, John Belfont. John Belfont is still in the land of the living. And well, Garfield, that started. Well, let's just use that as a starting point. Garfield Belfont was killed by the police, 1953. Then you had a young man by the name of Buddy Evans. Buddy Evans was from Nova Scotia. He was in an after-hours joint. He was killed by the police. Then people started organizing around the police situation. And an organization called the Black Action Defense Committee, Bad C, Black Action Defense Committee, which was founded by people like Charles Roach. He was a lawyer. He's no longer in the land of the living. One of the other leaders of the Black Action Defense Committee was a brother by the name of Dudley Laws. He was born in Jamaica, but he went to England. Then he came to Canada. You had a woman by the name of Sharona Hall. She was a sister that was born in Jamaica. She had a lot of ties with the liberation movements in Zimbabwe and so on and so forth. And you had another brother by the name of Lennox Farrell. He was another Trinidadian brother. He was a part of that group. Brother by the name of Owen Leach. He changed his name to Sankara. He was a part of that. Another brother, Mitchell Holder. It was a whole group of people from the Western Hemisphere that started this Black Action Defense Committee. And they basically made the police their issue. The Black Panthers came here. I don't think they ever had a chapter. But, you know, you had many of the formations that took place in the United States.
That allows us to think about nowadays. There have been George Floyd protests in every Canadian province and territory, including a march of about 4,000 people in Toronto. What more can you tell us about the African response to the death of George Floyd in Canada?
I think that the death of George Floyd in its relationship to Canada, I think that Canada basically took the same position that the world took, because, I mean, it was such a despicable display of police bestiality, and that the people in Canada, Africans as well as all white Canadians, and I mean, I think people all Belgian all over the world went off because it was. I guess it had a lot to do with, I guess, the fact that we were all contained. You know, we're all under lockdown all around the world, and there was no way you could not see what happened. And what happened to that brother was so glaring. I think it hit a chord with everyone. And African people, Pan-Africanism or African internationalism is in the air right now. You know, so
thanks for that. You referenced the lockdown in reference to the COVID-19 pandemic, or as we in the WHO movement called the colonial virus. Canada has been praised by liberal sectors of society for some of the steps it has taken to prevent the spread of COVID-19. However, Africans and other colonized people in Canada have rates at least three times that of whites. African neighborhoods in Toronto have been the hardest hit. Can you explain some of the impact COVID-19 has had on Africans in Toronto and throughout Canada?
Black people and other people of color make up 83% of the reported COVID-19 cases in Toronto. 21% of the reported cases affect Black people, who make up only 9% of the city's overall population.
You are listening to the People's War Radio Show, produced by WBPU, Black Power 96.3 in St. Petersburg, Florida. Our show today is entitled Black Power in the Great White North. And our guest today is Norman Jalali Richmond, an African Liberation Movement leader from Toronto, Canada, and the host of Diasporic Music on Black Power 96.3. So, next question. Earlier, you were talking about an organization that you founded, the Afro-American Progressive Association, one of the first Black Power groups in Canada. As well, you also helped found
yes, sir.
And lead the Biko Rodney Malcolm Coalition. What is the history of African liberation in Canada?
Oh, first of all, you had African people. I can't go through a whole. Let me say that, you know, you had Mary Ann Shadd had a newspaper in Canada years and years ago. And also Henry Bibb had a newspaper in Canada. I think both of them. Well, I think Henry Bibb came out of the United States and they crossed over into Canada. Both of them started newspapers and they had a professional rivalry. And I think, I believe that Bibb was a little bit more nationalistic than Mary Ann Shadd. Mary Ann Shadd Carey. And of course you had the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League. They started in Canada in 1921, I believe. My dates might be off. And they had a Liberty Hall here on a street called College Street. And Marcus Garvey came here many, many, many times. And I think the last meeting that he had was in 1937. He came to Canada and they had a school up here. And they trained a lot of people who went on to, you know, lead the Garvey movement around the world. But, you know, the Garvey movement, Garvey came up here many, many, many years. I remember in 1937, I had a brother by the name of Leonard Oscar Johnston. He was born and raised in Canada, and he used to be a porter, railroad porter, and he saved his money and started a bookstore called the Third World Bookstore. And Third World Books and Crafts, he and his wife, Gwen Johnston, had the bookstore. And he was a member of the Communist Party. And he quit the Communist Party. And he joined the Afro-American Progressive Association. And me and him used to argue over Garvey versus Du Bois. Lenny was one of what was, like I say, he was one of my mentors.
And one of the things that you're very into, you're really a pioneer in, is African music. A lot of people,
yes,
know the song Redemption Song by Bob Marley, where he says, "Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind." Well, that line actually comes from a speech given by Marcus Garvey at Menelik Hall in Nova Scotia, exactly, where he says, "We're going to emancipate ourselves from mental slavery. Mind is your only ruler sovereign. The man who is not able to develop and use his mind is bound to be slave to the other man who uses his mind." Now, Malcolm's parents also met in Canada. Can you give us a little bit more insight on that?
I'm laughing because Louise Little Langdon, that was Malcolm X's mother. And Malcolm X's mother was born in a place called La Digue, Grenada, which was the home of Maurice Bishop in the New Jew movement. Maurice Bishop, Benoit Cord, and Selwyn Strawn, and I forgot all Jacqueline Kraft. She was killed with Maurice Bishop. But anyway, Malcolm's mother came to Nova Scotia many years ago. She came to Nova Scotia, and you know, they had a Caribbean community there, and they were worried about her. They did not want her to marry a Euro person. So they sent her to Montreal. And when she was in Montreal, she was at a Marcus Garvey meeting, and she met Earl Little, Malcolm X's father. And they were married in Montreal. And came back to, you know, they lived all over Omaha, Nebraska, blah, 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 Michigan, and so on and so forth. But yeah, they actually met in at a UNIA convention in Montreal, Quebec. Yeah.
As noted, I have in-laws in Canada, from Vancouver to Calgary to Toronto, you know, I think probably some in between. I've noticed that Africans in Canada often hold strong connections with the countries they come from. People might call themselves Jamaicans, Trinidadians, Haitians, etc. But why is it important for Africans in Canada to embrace a global African identity as they struggle to overturn the issues plaguing Black people in Canada?
I have a problem with that because I have been conscious of Africa since I was 14 years old. When I was 14 years old, I never will forget, as long as I live, they killed Patrice Lumumba. Well, I shouldn't say they killed Patrice Lumumba. They killed Patrice Lumumba, Joseph Okito, and Maurice Mpolo. I remember those three names are burning my memory. And I remember I was just going to school there, and I had just left middle school or junior high school, as we called it back then. And there was a young man by the name of Charles Wright. And Charles Wright was a guy who had an automobile. He had all of the girls. He was one of the best dressed people. And he was a part of Al Prentice Bunchy's Carter, had a set of the street organization. There were street organizations in Los Angeles. There was the Slauson's, went Fremont, and then the Businessmen's were at Jefferson High School, and the Gladiators were at Manual Arts High School. And Bunchy Carter had a set of Slauson's called the Renegade Slauson's. And Charles Wright was a part of Bunchy Carter's Renegade Slauson's. And I never will forget, as long as I live, he was making fun of the name of Africans, of the Africans that had got killed. Oh, Kasabubu, Kasabubu. And he was making fun of the names. And there was a brother from the Nation of Islam. And, you know, when Charles was going through his thing, the brother from the Nation of Islam saw me and called me. He says, come over here, young brother. He says, that Negro, what you think about what that Negro is saying? I said, it don't make no sense to me. I don't know who was Kasivuvu, but I don't know what this Kasibubu stuff. He said, would you like to hear the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad? I was 14. Might have been 13, getting ready to turn 14, because I was born in March, and Lumumba was killed in January 17th, 1961. And anyway, he says, all right, would you like to hear the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad? And my thing was, I had relatives that were in the Nation of Islam, but I really didn't know them at that particular time. I say, of course, let me go here. Who the Honorable Elijah Muhammad? And when I went to the mosque, there was a brother by the name of John Shabazz. He's still in the land of the living. I think he was a great son, just like Malcolm. I think he was out of St. Louis. And I was captivated. I never joined the Nation of Islam, but I definitely became a big sympathizer. And he was talking about the death of Lumumba and breaking down Africa, so on and so forth.
In keeping with that, what do you think that activists nowadays in Canada could learn from that period? What do you think they could learn from African internationalism and really a global African identity?
I think that the first thing is the question of identity. I think is very important, because I think that I'm not going to tell anybody that they can't identify where, if you were born in Antigua, if you were born in Zanzibar, if you want to, you know, hold on to, you know, your set, that's fine. but we're still all African people, you know. And African internationalism makes sense to me because we are an identity. We are Africans, and we should unite. And I think we are the when I say we, I mean we as a people. We are the most oppressed. I mean, Ho Chi Minh, the great leader of the Vietnamese Revolution, said that, you know, the Africans were the most oppressed people in the world. And it has nothing to do with melanin or being biologically superior to anybody. But objectively, our material conditions put us, pardon me, in a situation where we are in a position to lead a worldwide African revolution against capitalism, leading to socialism.
Like I said, when I go to visit my family, you know, I'll see Trinidadian Association and Guyanese Association and Antiguan Association. And there might be cultural things through which people come together, Cara Fest or something like that. But when an African is killed by the police, if the African is from Somalia or Sudan or something, then someone might say, wow, you know, that sucks what happened to that Sudanese kid. They need to take better care of their community, as opposed to understanding that these are all universal conditions that Africans share, not just in Canada, not just in Toronto too, because that's something they'll try to say, but a universal condition all around the world. So let's move into some other interests of yours. Revolutionary culture, because I know that was one of the focuses of the Biko Rodney Malcolm Coalition that you led, was the role of revolutionary culture. What role has revolutionary culture played in the struggle for African liberation internationally and in Canada?
The Biko Rodney Malcolm Coalition was started by people from North America, the Caribbean, and Africa, specifically South Africa. And some of the people in the South African brother by the name of Gerald Pacobi, he was in the Black Consciousness Movement. Yes, yeah. It was Stephen Biko's group. And we took the position that we were African people, and we use the term Biko Rodney Malcolm Coalition because Biko was from South Africa, Walter Rodney was from Guyana, and Malcolm, of course, was from the United States with, you know, Georgia and Grenadian roots. So we basically tried to use those three people to bring us together. You know, when I say bring us together, that was, we always had the universal, Carlos Cooks, I should say that I love Carlos Cooks, but Carlos Cooks was an anti-communist. And we had, you know, Carlos had a big problem with, Carlos, brother Cooks had a big problem with Castro. And, you know, one of the things that I have been accused of by a lot of my Black nationalist friends, and I really loved Fidel, Raul, and Ernesto Che Guevara. And Ernesto Che Guevara's roots are Argentinian, and I think his daddy was an Irishman. But you know, I was held up Che Guevara. I held up Fidel and Raul because of their practice in terms of what they actually went to. You know, Ernesto Che Guevara actually went to the Congo and fought. You know what I mean? And so, you know, I never bought that particular lie. And I think there's one thing that I united and continue to unite with Huey P. Newton on, that Blackness is necessary, very necessary, but it is not sufficient. Because Mobutu, he had a lot of melanin. He was black, and he had about 50 wives, and he made everybody change their name. He had a whole Africanization program. He made everybody change their name, wear African clothes. But he was in bed with he was in bed with U.S. imperialism, Belgium imperialism, and the World Bank.
You are listening to the People's War Radio Show, produced by WBPU, Black Power 96.3 in St. Petersburg, Florida. Our show today is entitled Black Power in the Great White North. And our guest today is Norman Jalali Richmond, an African Liberation Movement leader from Toronto, Canada, and the host of Diasporic Music on Black Power 96.3. Jalali, as the host of Diasporic Music, what can you tell us about the role of revolutionary culture in the African liberation struggle?
I think the role of culture is very, very, very important. But I don't think that the cultural workers don't have the final say. But I think the political line is the most important thing. I think, cultural workers are forced to support the struggle now. Like, I personally think that Beyoncé is a great artist, and I actually think she can act. I actually think she can sing, but she is not the leader of the African Revolution, and especially working with Disney. I think Disney is not a part of the problem. Disney is the problem. But when we talk about other cultural workers like Max Roach or an Aminata Museka, who was married to Max Roach, and she was known at one time as Abby Lincoln, artists like that have always supported the African liberation movement. Max Roach did a thing called We Insist Freedom Now Sweet. I think that was recorded in 1959, 1960, banned by all, those records, and Lena Horne's record and Randy Weston's records from 1964, all of that stuff was banned in South Africa, and all of Paul Robeson's stuff, because, the music and the films and poetry, it's even more pronounced today with social media, but back then, the music and the culture was very powerful and has always been powerful. But Aminata Museka, Max Roach, people like Randy Weston, later on, you had Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, the I3s, the whole reggae situation. Then you had the hip hop. The beginning of hip hop was no matter what people might think of N.W.A., they scared the police to death, And you also had a lot of conscious hip hop artists, and they never got the airplay, but. And then just the skill, someone like Rakim. You got two sides of culture. You have the content and the form. And the form of black music, listening to Mahalia Jackson sing, just form, the way she sings is so beautiful. But Mahalia Jackson was Martin Luther King's musical lieutenant. Bob Marley, Fela Kuti was like could be called a musical lieutenant of President Thomas Sankara of Burkina Faso, and Walter Rodney could be Bob Marley was a musical lieutenant of Walter Rodney, and Walter Rodney and Bob Marley can be united when it comes to the cultural question.
So you offered some pretty solid criticism of contemporary cultural workers. What do you think that young African cultural workers can learn from the people of the generation that you came up in?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say that it's very difficult in that to be in that particular, in that situation, because first of all, you want to be able to earn a living. And I'm not going to tell anybody what they can and they can't do in terms of the art. But if you're committed to, you know, to the struggle, well, Jane Cortez used to tell me, if you're an artist, you have to have 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 different things you do in order to generate income if you want to be independent. But if you're going to be, you know, in the music business, you have to, you know, probably make those compromises. But, you know, try to find a way to, you know, supplement your income. You know, you might learn how to run a board or something, you know. You might be able to earn a living being a publicist. You might be able to earn a living having skills where you can, you know, supplement your income so you won't have to completely sell out, you know. But you got to make some money, unfortunately, under capitalism.
Uhuru. And I hear you loud and clear. So as a revolutionary cultural worker, what is the way forward for you? What's the way forward for us?
To keep on trucking, to keep on doing what we are doing. I mean, I think you know, the hip hop artist Boots Riley did a film. Boots Riley, he considers himself a communist, and he said that on national TV, and he's got films and he's won all kind of awards. You know, we have Dead Prez. I think they're doing great work, and it's not just the brothers but the sisters. You know, I can give you there's all kind of examples of culture workers that are continuing to put the message out, and like I say, figuring out a way how to pay your mortgage and look after, send your kids to school and be a revolutionary. If you can walk that tightrope, that's the way we have to go, you know, because we definitely need our children need political education even more than we need education. And especially political education, but I'm not telling people to drop out of school and that kind of stuff. I'm not arguing that.
Well, I did it. One final question. About a decade ago, you circulated a petition. The petition was for your radio show out of Toronto to gain national syndication. This is my first sort of endeavor into radio. What's some things that, what role do you think that revolutionary African internationalist radio plays in the struggle?
I think it's very important because Africans, radio is very, very important. And I think that on the African continent, you know, people are listening to radio on their cell phones and stuff, you know. It's not like you don't have to have in North America, we have, you know, radio stations, which I think are, I'm an older person and I have a son who doesn't listen to radio. He listens, everything is on his phone. And I think that's the way of the world in Uhuru Radio or Black Power 96. We're heard all over the world. And I think the role of revolutionary radio is to go all around the world. You know, let's take Black Power 96 to Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Let's take Dar es Salaam, or let's take Black Power 96 to Benin and Haiti, Georgetown, Guyana, and you know, let's take it to Ecuador. Let's take it to Halifax, Nova Scotia, and the Pacific Islands.
Thanks for that. Because
that's how I see it.
Amilcar Cabral actually spoke towards the revolutionary use of radio to organize people over there in Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde as well. So some of the different shows that circulated through the African radios, many of the revolutionaries suggested, played a very important role. We know people like Robert F. Williams and his Radio Free Dixie and other things like that. So I just really want to salute you. I want to salute you.
Could I say one last thing? That Amilcar Cabral, speaking in 1965 in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, I guess you would say he sent a shout out to the Africans in Los Angeles, California, during the Watts Rebellion, saying that the he was speaking in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, at a meeting of the liberation movements, the Frelimo. I don't know. That's the acronym
the Mozambique Liberation Front or something like that.
No, that was Mozambique. That's Mozambique.
Yeah, Frelimo.
Mozambique. Frelimo. Frelimo. I'm sorry. And then Angola was MPLA. And the PIGC, they were having a conference, all the Portuguese colonies, and they were meeting in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. He sent a shout out to the people who were rumbling in Los Angeles, California. Yeah,
because just like Minnesota, Los Angeles, Detroit, and so many other places here in the belly of the beast, we know that Africans up here in North America are central to the revolutionary struggle and the liberation of African people everywhere. You understood that, Garvey understands that. That's what Chairman Omalia Shetela teaches us as well. So I'd like to really just once again thank you, salute you for all your work, and I'll talk to you soon. You are listening to the People's War Radio Show, produced by WBPU. Black Power 96.3 in St. Petersburg, Florida. Our show today is entitled Black Power in the Great White North. And our guest today is Norman Jalali Richmond, an African Liberation Movement leader from Toronto, Canada, and the host of Diasporic Music on Black Power 96.3.
Uhuru, this is Michelle Rowe Odom, Matsumela's partner. As Matsumela noted earlier, I was born and raised in Calgary, Alberta, where my parents migrated to in the 1970s from Antigua and Jamaica by the way of England. I would like to introduce to you a very special treat. Just weeks before he was assassinated, Malcolm X completed an interview in Toronto, Canada on January 5th, 1965. Archival recordings of that interview have recently reemerged, and I would like to share it with you. In this interview, Malcolm X explains his ideological shifts, his recent Hajj to Mecca, and the political program of the Organization of Afro-American Unity. I hope you take as much from this historic clip as I have. Let's continue to struggle for African self-determination in Canada, the Caribbean, the US, Africa, and everywhere African people are. Uhuru.
I don't advocate any kind of hate.
There's a lot of talk that sounds very much like it.
No, I think that the guilt complex of the American white man is so profound until when you begin to analyze the real condition of the black man in America, instead of the American white man eliminating the causes that create that condition, he tries to cover it up by accusing his accusers of teaching hate. But actually, they're just exposing him for being responsible for what exists. I don't in any way encourage black people to go out and initiate acts of aggression indiscriminately against whites. But I do believe that the black man in the United States and any human being anywhere is well within his right to do whatever is necessary by any means necessary to protect his life and property, especially in a country where the federal government itself has proven that it is either unable or unwilling to protect the lives and property of those human beings.
Just before Pierre takes it, you've got a pretty good fighter and the world's heavyweight champion lined up with you to help out. Yes, Pierre.
Are you still a Muslim yourself?
Oh, yes. I'm a Muslim. I believe in the religion of Islam, which believes in brotherhood, complete brotherhood of all people. But at the same time that I believe in this brotherhood, I don't believe enforcing my desire for brotherhood upon those who aren't willing to accept it.
Of course, I think the Christians would say that they also believed in brotherhood. What did you say to that?
I'd say they believe in it, but don't practice it.
Well, that'd be a pretty good answer.
Sir, when the muezzin goes up in the minaret twice a day, he cries to the world, "There is but one God, and he is Allah." Do you deny that there is a Christian God?
The muezzin does this five times a day.
Five times, and I only heard him twice.
Well, you were fortunate to hear him twice. But he does this five times a day, and the same God that he says that he expresses the existence of is the God that the Christians profess to believe in themselves, and the God that the Jews believe in, one God, the creator of the universe. The Muslims believe in the God that created the universe, and I think the Christians do, and the Jews do. Now, as long as all of them are talking about the creator, the Jews may call him Jehovah, and Christians may have another name for him. Those who are Arabic-speaking refer to him as Allah. Well, we believe in the same God.
Now, when you went to Mecca, this is a very sacred and forbidden city. I tried to get to Mecca myself and certainly didn't make it, not being a Muslim. But how would they accept you as one? You're an American. There are few American Muslims.
This is true. And by being an American and not having not being able to speak the Arabic language, I did strike a snag, a very serious snag. But I was fortunate to have been pretty well known by the officials in Arabia, and they knew too that I had accepted Orthodox Islam. It had been highly publicized in the paper, and I became a guest of the state. I was a guest of Prince Faisal, the present King Faisal, and they made it possible for me to go before the committee, Hajj committee or Hajj court, who examines you and asks you questions about your belief. And if you pass it, then you are okay to go to Mecca. But
you would
true.
Have to have a translator then.
Oh, I had one. Then we realizing that our problem in America, that we are black Americans and we have a problem that goes beyond religion, we formed a group known as the Organization of Afro-American Unity. And the objective of this organization, it's non-religious, number one, any Negro can belong to it. And the objective of that organization is to bring about a condition that will guarantee respect and recognition of the 22 million black Americans as human beings. We feel that the problem, number one, of the black man in America is beyond America's ability to solve. It's a human problem, not an American problem or a Negro problem. And as a human problem or a world problem, we feel that it should be taken out of the jurisdiction of the United States government and the United States courts and taken into the United Nations in the same manner that the problems of the black man in South Africa, Angola, and other parts of the world, and even the way they're trying to bring the problems of the Jews in Russia into the United Nations because of violation of human rights. We believe that our problem is one not of violation of civil rights, but a violation of human rights. Not only are we denied the right to be a citizen in the United States, we're denied the right to be a human being. Thank you.
The People's War Radio Show is produced by WBPU, Black Power 96.3 in St. Petersburg, Florida. WBPU is a project of the African People's Education and Defense Fund, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to defend the human rights and civil rights of the African community and address the grave disparities faced by African people in education, healthcare, and economic development. For more information on the African People's Education and Defense Fund, visit apedf.org. Episodes of the People's War Radio Show are available on the Black Power Talks podcast on wubp.podbean.com. For updates and resources to fight the coronavirus or to volunteer with the Black Ankh Project, visit developmentforafrica.org. We'd like to thank our guest, Norman Jalali Richmond, for joining us today. We would also like to thank you, our listeners, for tuning in.